I'm Jamila Kremple, in for Tom Hall, and this is Midday. Today, with school about to start, we ask, does sexual education in Maryland schools reflect the world we live in? Is it inclusive of LGBTQ students? Is the Me Too movement changing what's being taught in the classroom? And if so, is it enough? What are students learning about consent and sexual assault? We'll hear from school educators and from experts at Planned Parenthood and Healthy Teen Network. Plus, a high school student gives us their perspective on what students want to know and how they want to learn it. They'll all join me for a lesson in what they teach and how to talk with your own kids about sex. We'll take your calls and emails when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon. Welcome to Midday. I'm Jamila Kremple, in for Tom Hall. Depending on your age and where you grew up, you may have had a sex ed class in middle or high school that mostly covered anatomy, your changing body, the mechanics of sex, reproduction, and how to avoid it. If you were in school in the later part of the 20th century, you may have also learned about STD prevention. And while all of these topics are incredibly important for a young person to learn, it's not all there is to know. In the era of the Me Too movement, when there are frequent headlines about actors, politicians, clergy, executives, people in virtually every profession being accused of sexual assault, is sex ed teaching students how power is used to hurt others and the importance of consent? Have schools updated their curriculum to reflect students' gender identity and sexual orientation? We'll be asking all of these questions today in an effort to learn if sex ed curriculum is becoming more comprehensive and to learn what the goals of sex education are. We wanted to get a picture of what's being taught in classes around the state, so we reached out to 7 public school systems from Baltimore City and Baltimore County to Howard and Arundel County, Frederick, and on and on. And 6 of these school systems either didn't respond to our request or said no one in the school system was available to talk about what they're teaching. But we do have plenty of guests today. A bit later in the show, I'll be joined by longtime Baltimore author and sex educator Deborah Rothman and 2 health educators from Planned Parenthood of Maryland. But first, Tamara Mills is the coordinator of instruction for Worcester County Public Schools on the Eastern Shore. She joins me on the line from Snow Hill, Maryland, where she's attending the new teacher induction program. And Dr. Patricia Paluzzi is here in Studio A. She's the president and CEO of Healthy Teen Network here in Baltimore, an organization that focuses on improving the health and well-being of teenagers. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having us.
Listeners, you can join the conversation too. Call us with your questions and comments at 410-662-8780 or email us midday@wypr.org. You can also tweet us. We're at @MiddayWYPR. Dr. Paluzzi, let's start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about the work that Healthy Teen Network does around sexual education and a little bit about your work, your involvement with Baltimore City schools?
Sure. Thank you. Healthy Teen Network, as you said, is a national organization. We have been around since 1979. Our focus is on promoting health and well-being among teens and young adults, including those who are pregnant or parenting. We do have also a focus, though, on promoting healthy sexual behaviors, which can include teen pregnancy prevention, STI prevention, et cetera. We do our work more as a capacity-building agency, so our focus is on those professionals who work with young people as opposed to the young people themselves. We're not a direct service agency. Mm-hmm. So sex ed, of course, is a very important part of teaching young people how to make decisions around whether or not to be sexually active, who with, at what point in their lives, et cetera. We believe that sexual and reproductive health is a critical component of just health and well-being for all people, beginning with the young. And we believe that having the knowledge that you need to sort of think for yourself about whether or not you're ready physically, you're ready emotionally, you're making good choices, and then being prepared to have safer sex should you decide to go down that down that route is what's most important for all young people.
Okay. And what about your work with Baltimore City Public Schools?
Mm-hmm.
What capacity do you serve in?
Yeah. So we've been working with Baltimore City Health Department and the school since we moved to Baltimore from Washington, which was about 10 years ago now, I think. We started out by doing a citywide strategic plan to reduce teen births for the city at their request, and then have helped them to implement that plan ever since. And so in 2010, I think, was the first round of funding from the Office of Adolescent Health, where the Baltimore City Health Department, in partnership with the schools and Healthy Teen Network, received funding to begin to build the capacity of schools to adopt and implement some evidence-based programs for all 7th, 8th, and 9th graders across the city of Baltimore and all the public schools. And we've been doing that work ever since. And our particular focus is on the training of the teachers to be able to implement the sex ed programs. We also led the city through a very structured process to help them to select the programs that best would address the needs of the students of Baltimore specifically.
Okay, thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
Before we get into what's being taught, you know, what exactly is being taught in Worcester County and in Baltimore City schools, I just want to get, and I want listeners to have just kind of a picture, an understanding of the state standards. Tamara, can you tell us a little bit about what the state mandates for Maryland public school systems to teach in regards to sexual health education?
Absolutely. So family life and human sexuality is a part of the requirement for Maryland Comprehensive Health Education. It is in our COMAR, the Code of Maryland Regulations, for us to teach that. It is an exception program, though, which means that parents can opt their child out of it if they choose to teach that at home, and then students are given a health-related alternative assignment. Within that family life and human sexuality unit, within the health program, we provide materials and instruction. We make sure that the information is given as shortly in advance of puberty as is practical, which they generally give us a guideline of on or prior to fifth grade. So in our county, it's a fifth through ninth grade program. And we make sure that we promote healthy attitudes toward human sexuality. We encourage abstinence as the safest, healthiest, and only way to avoid negative consequences, helping students to navigate through their adolescence, and counteracting negative messages throughout the mass media when it comes to sexuality and how it's portrayed, and really making sure that there are available resources for students to help them and guide them through this development.
Mm-hmm. And so you teach abstinence only, but students do learn about contraception, right?
Sure. We teach factual information about its existence. We don't teach advocacy of it, though, because we are an abstinence-based program in our county. Different LEAs, local education agencies across the state, do have a different stance on that, or, you know, do have varying positions on that. So I'm just speaking for Worcester County.
Sure.
We do promote abstinence as the best and safest way.
Okay. Dr. Paluzzi, Healthy Teen Network has created, it has several position statements on different mm-hmm. issues, and you have one on sexual education. Can you give us an idea of how your organization defines comprehensive quality sex education?
So in our position statement, we follow what are called the National Sex Education Standards, and they've set out, I think, 10 statements about what should be included in a comprehensive set of sex ed standards. So things such as that you want to be sex positive. Now, some people probably are just kind of going crazy right now thinking I'm saying that sex is positive
yeah,
for teenagers to have, right? But what that means is you don't want to demonize sex. That's not what you're trying to do because, A, it doesn't really work. It doesn't really teach them anything. And then it can backfire in a way when most of them will at some point as adults or teenagers or whenever they decide become sexually active. So sex positive means that you recognize that sex in itself is not a bad thing. But there are ways that, you know, there are things you need to know. There are things you need to be prepared for. They also have to be very culturally appropriate, inclusive of all sort of kinds of youth, LGBTQ youth, et cetera. Trauma-informed, so thinking about kids who are, like, at greater risk, like kids in foster care and out-of-home settings, those sorts of kids. Consent, as you know, is a big issue. Sexual assault, as you talked about, the Me Too movement. So all of those things are included in sort of making sure that you're promoting, recognizing the common cultural values of a group, but their individual thoughts and feelings, their orientations, all of those things, and that you're age appropriate and that you're supported by evidence.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about sexual education in Maryland schools with Tamara Mills, the coordinator of instruction for Worcester County Public Schools on the Eastern Shore, and with Dr. Patricia Paluzzi. She's the president and CEO of Healthy Teen Network here in Baltimore. In 2016, the Maryland General Assembly passed a bill that requires Maryland public schools to develop and implement a program that focuses on the awareness and prevention of sexual abuse and assault. Dr. Paluzzi, what grades do Baltimore City students start learning about sexual assault, and what are they? Give us sort of a brief overview of what they're learning.
So what I understand of the two, and I would like you to repeat this question probably when you have the sex educators in the room, because
sure,
they're very much more intimately aware of what's involved in all the curricula. But there are two curricula being taught right now in the schools. It's Your Game, Keep It Real is for the 7th and 8th graders, and Making Proud Choices, the version for out-of-home youth or out-of-school youth, is being taught to 9th graders. Those programs, as I understand them, do a lot with building and recognizing healthy relationships, negotiating skills. So this means like negotiating like all kinds of situations you might find yourself in as a young person, and up through and including condom negotiation, should you be in a situation where you want to have sex with someone. So also sexual assault is certainly included in there. Human trafficking is included in there. Specifically in Making Proud Choices in 9th grade, those things are stressed more than they are in 7th and 8th through It's Your Game.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And Tamara, what about in Worcester County schools?
So in Worcester County, we actually implemented a program beginning when House Bill 72, Aaron's Law, was passed. We began teaching lessons actually as young as first grade. And what we started with are age-appropriate lessons about boundaries, about what is appropriate and not appropriate touching, things like that. Now, those lessons for first through eighth grade are taught by our school counselors, which are really the most equipped individuals in the school system to be able to teach those. And then in the high school health courses, our health certified instructors teach those. So we've really seen, and I think at first we were apprehensive about the parent reaction at such a young age, but what we found in working with our local community organizations like our Cricket Center, our Life Crisis Center, those types of resources and organizations, we found that we're really making the community more aware of the issues surrounding children, sexual abuse with children, sexual abuse in families and with people that they know and trusted. And so I think it's really been a benefit to our school system and to our communities.
And this past spring, the you said it's called Aaron's Law?
Law, and it's Maryland House Bill 72.
And there was, I guess you could say, an expansion of what schools are teaching about sexual assault. In just this past spring, the General Assembly passed a bill that would require public schools to teach the meaning of consent and respect for personal boundaries. And the legislation will be implemented for the first time in this upcoming school year. Dr. Paluzzi, what will that look like in Baltimore City schools?
I'm not really sure.
Okay.
I cannot really address that question.
This is the first time.
Yeah. So what I can say, though, is that I think that what's important for Aaron's Law is some of the language where we've gotten much more specific about that yes means yes. And so I think that we'll probably be working on trying to figure out if there are, like, additional information. I know that they've done some they do newsletters for the teachers that have been taught, and I know they've done additional work around consent in those, but sort of updating the language. That the reason behind that is that you can hear all kinds of stories about if a girl doesn't answer, well, she didn't say no, you know, but no, her, she didn't say no doesn't is not the same as she said yes. Mm-hmm. And so this, I don't think that the programs we're currently training on use that specific language, and I think we'll be trying to figure out ways to incorporate that.
I see. Mm-hmm. And Tamara, how about in Worcester County schools? What are you preparing to teach about consent?
Yeah, so our biggest piece of that, it's Maryland House Bill 251, for the consent piece, is really about training our teachers. All teachers who provide family life and human sexuality units are required to have a training. And I think part of that, well, not I think, but this year, what we've implemented is in the training new this year is really educating the teachers about the common language and the affirmative consent, what that means, what it is, and then making sure that they share that in their lessons and incorporate that into their units with the students in grades 5 through 9 in particular, and making sure that they have a very strong understanding so that they can then relate that to students.
Mm-hmm. And Tamara, we've got a email for you, I guess, or for a representative of Worcester County. Tim emails us and says, could I ask you how teen pregnancy rates compare with and what compare in other, excuse me, how teen pregnancy rates in Worcester County compare with other counties in Maryland? He says it's astounding that abstinence continues to have any validity after years of abysmal failure.
Yeah, so we have seen the cycle go up and down. It's actually slightly on the rise lately. We had several years where it dipped below the state average, so we tend to fluctuate. But really what I think is important, too, is that what's being taught in our school system is really generally a reflection of our community and what they're looking for their children. We really, within our program also, we really hope to have parents be partners with us. We want to make sure as public educators that our parents are partners in education, whether it be with reading or math or science or family life. And so it's important to still make sure that our parents have the opportunities to teach these things first, and then when they don't, that becomes, you know, then that falls to the school system. But, you know, it's definitely a hot topic. We definitely have people in our community on both sides of that issue. And we do constantly try to take a look at the research and take a look at the data. One thing we've done lately, as we did see a slight increase in recent years, is we've partnered with a local agency who provides services for any pregnant teens we may have in the county and giving them the resources they need. We're a small rural community for the most part, so getting in children that information is also helpful. But, you know, certainly we constantly take a look at the data as educators.
And Dr. Paluzzi, you were wanting to get in and chime in. We have about a minute left.
A minute left.
Sure.
Okay. So I think, you know, I certainly agree that it's important. You want your parents to be involved. I think I would say that asking the parents, you want to respect what the parents have to say, but I think that the difference in approach sometimes between an abstinence-only and a comprehensive sex approach falls down in two ways. One is, first of all, a comprehensive sex ed approach includes abstinence, and there's a very age appropriateness to abstinence, particularly obviously in your younger children, but you always have to be driven by data, and the data in your schools and your student bodies, there's something called youth risk behavioral survey that's done every year. Those data should be telling you what your kids need. Parents are not always going to know, and they're scared, and they're not uncomfortable. So if you're having higher rates of teen sexual activity as reported by the young people themselves, I think you have to consider that over maybe what your parents say that they want, in terms of no parent feels like their kid's going to be the one having sex. No parent wants to be talking to their kid about sex. They're very uncomfortable with it. But I'm not sure they can drive your decisions to give young people all the information they need. So should they have sex, wanted or not wanted, they can at least protect themselves in some way and do it safely.
I'm going to add 15 more seconds to my for my minute deadline, but can you just give us a quick update on where things stand with the teen pregnancy prevention program? Listeners may remember last spring, the Trump administration pulled funding 2 years before the deadline.
That's
but
right.
A judge ruled that it must be reinstated.
Right. So it's important to note that the project that I'm talking about, the one where we're doing the training, first of all, I want you to know that 17,827 kids have been impacted by this training since 2010. That's a lot of young people, like over 6,000 middle school kids and over 11,500 ninth graders have received some kind of received these programs. So when they cut that, we sued. Baltimore Healthy Teen Network sued. Baltimore City joined the suit. We won the suit. We were then able to ask for our money. We actually received our money, and we're continuing on. However, there has been an appeal filed. So we're all proceeding as if we have this next year to do our work while this kind of continues to go down the courts.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you both for joining us. Dr. Patricia Paluzzi is the president and CEO of Healthy Teen Network, a 501c3 that works with health professionals and organizations focused on teen health. Healthy Teen Network is a partner in the hashtag HealthyTeen18 Design Challenge, which invites educators and students, other members of the public, to recommend ways that sex ed can become can include better conversations around sex and pleasure. We'll have more on our website, wipr.org/midday. Tamara Mills is the coordinator of instruction for Worcester County Public Schools on the Eastern Shore. Thank you both again. When we come back after a quick break, we'll continue to talk about sexual education in Maryland in the coming school year. What do students want to learn, and how can guardians be their primary source of information? You can join the conversation, too. Call us with your questions and comments, 410-662-8780, or email us. We're at midday@wipr.org. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
It's midday. I'm guest host Jamila Krempel in for Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, guest host Aaron Henkin considers the state of artificial intelligence technology, the next likely advances in AI, and how the human-machine link could be altering the course of our civilization. That's tomorrow on midday. If you're just joining us, school's about to start, and we're discussing sex education. Has the sex ed curriculum kept up with the times? Is it inclusive of all students, including students who are LGBTQ? And at a time when the news is full of stories of sexual assault at the hands of powerful men and some women, are sex ed classes doing enough to teach students about assault and the meaning of consent? Joining me now in Studio A is Deborah Rothman. She's a sexuality educator, consultant, and author based here in Baltimore. She's taught human sexuality education at the Park School for more than 35 years. Her latest book is Talk to Me First, Everything You Need to Know to Become Your Kid's Go-To Person About Sex. Time magazine named her one of the top parenting experts for the 21st century. That's high praise. And Valerie Pasquale is here. She's a community health educator with Planned Parenthood of Maryland. And Dominique Thurman is also here with us in Studio A. She's a sophomore at the Baltimore School for the Arts and peer educator for Planned Parenthood of Maryland. You're welcome to be part of this conversation, too. Call us with your questions and comments at 410-662-8780 or email us. We're at midday. We're midday@wipr.org. We're also live streaming this conversation at the WYPR Facebook page. Leave your comments there, or you can also tweet us. We're at @MiddayWYPR. Valerie, let me start with you. We've been talking about how schools are making their sexual health curriculum more representative of the experiences and of some of the challenges of students. Tell us a little bit about how Planned Parenthood is doing this.
So Planned Parenthood of Maryland teaches sexuality education across the lifespan, starting from as early as fourth and fifth grade, with some core concepts about teaching young children bodily autonomy, all the way up through high school, teaching folks about consent, sexual harassment, and sexual assault. We provide medically accurate, age-appropriate sex education, and we're very proud to do so. We've been doing so for 40-plus years, mostly in Baltimore City and some on the Eastern Shore as well.
Okay. Dominique, why did you want to work with Planned Parenthood of Maryland? And tell me about some of the things that you do as a peer educator.
So in eighth grade, I only had sexual education in eighth grade, and later on in the future, I wanted to go more in depth with female health than being a doctor, like a midwife. And Planned Parenthood actually came to my class in eighth grade, and we only had a little bit of time because we could only get them at the end of the year. So Vanessa, she was like, I see you're really into it, so I think the peer education program would be really good for you. And you know, you get a little stipend, and we have food.
Oh, and so the deal.
So I was like, okay. And I've always been into sexual health and education. I just been into it. Mm-hmm. So I'm a 2-year now. I've been in it for 2 years. We help teens be more comfortable with sexual education, because I know being in 8th grade, the boys and the girls, we was looking at each other when they was like sex and vagina, you know, all that. And so we just help teenagers be more comfortable. And every 3rd or 4th Thursday, we do a presentation that's public to high schoolers. And it can be about STIs, healthy relationships, and so on and so forth. Just to normalize it and to help other teens be more aware.
Okay. And Debbie, you've written several books about how to talk about human sexuality with young people. And you advise school systems. You obviously work in a school yourself. Are there target ages when students should be learning particular things about human sexuality, their bodies?
That's sort of a loaded question to me, because in the state of sexuality education today, we really, as was said before, we really tend to start at 4th or 5th grade, which really puts our students at a disadvantage. So that we're ending up starting at that age, teaching them basic concepts that they needed to know when they were 4, 5, and 6 years old. So that this is how we teach everything else. Right, we teach younger children the basics in an increasingly sophisticated spiral of learning and knowledge, so that we're really disabling them in terms of not only their basic knowledge, and they're not growing up in a vacuum, that's for sure. So they're having to by the time we get them, we have to help them unlearn things before we can help them learn. And sometimes, because what you learn first sticks longest, it's very difficult. You can undo it for a while, but I see them again in high school, and they often reverted back to misperceptions they had when they were quite young. Hmm. So absolutely, I concur that there should be a spiral. It can be a really pre-K through 12 spiral based on not simply stay out of trouble education, which a lot of the focus is, but on the notion that children are sexual and gendered beings from the moment of birth on. This is not, we think of, you know, the adult as the gatekeeper. I have the knowledge in this box. Can I turn it over when I think the children are ready or when I'm ready, right? Instead of understanding that this is part of who children are from birth, in fact, in some ways before birth, and our job as adults is to nurture what's there. Mm.
And what about for the parent or the adult that is uncomfortable with that concept of their, let's say, 8-year-old sort of being a, I don't know if you use the term sexual being, but the word sexual was in there. Yeah. How do you, what's just sort of the foundational information that parents should feel more comfortable giving them?
Well, I'll respond in two ways. And what I mean by sexual, in America, when people say sexual, they think about people having sex, which is not what's happening at all here, obviously. So children physically are born with a sexual response system. We know that because we see children enjoying touching their genitals. That's a positive experience for them. And the other way that it starts very early on is what the first thing anybody ever says about babies is their gender. So that gender learning begins immediately. But if we listen in to their questions, and I think this is very comforting for a lot of adults, I know I find this true at Park and wherever I go, that we don't have to, children will tell us what they need and want to know when they're quite young, at ages 4, 5, and 6. And if we are willing to listen to their questions and think of this subject as all others, we get the secret. The big secret about handling this topic is there's no secret. If all we need to do is learn how to deal with it and respond to it in the same ways as we do all others.
Valerie, we have a question that maybe you can answer. We're just going to go to the phone. Julie is on the phone. She's got a question about, let me just have Julia say it herself. Julia, you're on the line with Valerie and Dominique and Debbie. How are you?
I'm fine. It has crossed my mind in teaching children about inappropriate touching by others, I guess, including parents. How do you teach a child that their mother or father no longer needs to help them take a bath? And how would the child get that across to the parent that, no, mommy, I know you love me, but I don't want you touching me there anymore?
Hmm. Is that something that you cover in the curriculum? I mentioned you said earlier about bodily autonomy, students early learning that. What can you kind of share with Julie about that?
Yeah, so Julie, that's a great question. I personally do not run into that a lot as I start with grades 4th and 5th, and at that point, usually the students that I run across, that is not a concern that they bring up. However, we do talk about, as far as inappropriate touching goes, we talk about inappropriate, well, not really inappropriate, but self-touching. It's not inappropriate at all, as long as it's done in a private setting. So that is what I can contribute, is that we do talk about when it is and where it is and isn't appropriate to touch oneself. So in a private place, not in public. We do not teach younger than grades 4th and 5th. Not that we do not want to, just we usually cannot get into the schools that early.
I see. In all of your work, I'm curious as to how you instruct students to ask for consent and how to give it. Like, what does that sound like? What does that look like? Dominique or Debbie, do you want to?
Yeah, I think we tend to take buzzwords like consent and focus on them in a very specific way at an age that we think is important. But if you think about it, what consent is about is respect for boundaries. And we hopefully are teaching children that from the earliest age possible in lots and lots and lots of ways. Life is full of boundaries that we need to learn to respect. So that if we're giving them, we'll call it boundary education, in positive ways, as well as ways, here's something you need to be aware of to not cross, then teaching them about sexual consent is just part of that big picture of teaching respect for boundaries. I think we also have to look, they're not in a vacuum, as I said before, and as everybody knows. Look at the images that are out there, particularly about women who are depicted ad nauseum as not having boundaries, as being semi-naked, in some cases naked, with smiles on their faces, making it seem as if, oh, okay, all right, I don't really have boundaries. Come and touch at will or look at will. So we're essentially teaching kids not to disregard boundaries when it comes to the sexual parts of ourselves.
So during our training, when we talk about consent, it's mostly included in relationships. In relationships, you must have consent and trust in it. And so consent, as we were saying, we point out how in movies and TV shows, you don't really see consent. You just see kissing and then you just go straight to the bed. You don't see, is this okay and everything. And we go through fries, what we say, fries, which is F is for freely given, R is for reversible, I is for informed, E is for enthusiastic, and S is for specific. And we go through fries and to make sure that we know that consent is this, this, and this, and you have to go through all of them in order for you to have a consentful sexual action.
Excellent. Thank you for sharing that acronym with us. I'm sure a lot of people will use that. Before we're coming up on a break, but I just wanted to get to this to Mike from Hunt Valley. He called, but he couldn't stay on the line. But he had a question about how do educators, school systems deal with some parents not agreeing with the entire curriculum? Valerie, do you have some thoughts or some experience on that?
So as far as dealing with parents who have some concerns about the curriculum, usually before we go into a school, we have an educator, or in some cases our vice president of education, meets with parents and has a parent chat, a parent coffee, if you will, where parents are allowed to voice their concerns, and we are allowed to, we are given the forum to speak to them and have an open discussion about the topics we teach and why we think they're so important. We might get pushback from teaching certain topics at certain ages, and we're able to provide them with the data, with the anecdotes also, of why it is so important to talk about things like STD prevention or consent at certain ages, why it is important.
Okay, great. We're going to talk a little bit more about that, about your work with parents and how you advise them to bring up these conversations and what should be covered on the other side of the break. Valerie Pasquale, we're here with Pasquale. She's a community health educator with Planned Parenthood of Maryland. Dominique Thurman is a peer educator for Planned Parenthood of Maryland also. And Debbie Rothman is a human sexuality educator, teacher at Park School, at the Park School, and author. Quick break, and when we return, we'll take more of your comments and questions. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or email us. We're at midday. We're midday at wypr.org. I'll get it right in the next segment. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
I'm Jamila Krumple, WYPR's digital producer, and for Tom Hall, and you're listening to Midday. If you've just joined us, we're talking about sex education. Are today's sex ed classes more inclusive of LGBTQ students, for example? And are they teaching all students about the importance of consent? Valerie Pasquale is a community health educator with Planned Parenthood of Maryland. Dominique Thurman is a peer educator for Planned Parenthood of Maryland also, and she's a sophomore at the Baltimore School for the Arts. Debbie Rothman has taught sexuality education at the Park School here in Baltimore for more than 35 years, and she's the author of three books that offer advice on how to teach kids about human sexuality. You're welcome to join the conversation. You can call us with your comments and questions at 410-662-8780, or you can email us. We're at midday at wypr.org. We're also live streaming this conversation at the WYPR Facebook page. You can leave your comments there, or you can also tweet us. We're at midday WYPR. Valerie, you wanted to offer a follow-up to Julia's question about sort of what's healthy, a healthy interaction, healthy touching, or if a student doesn't feel comfortable having a bath with their parent or guardian at a certain age.
Yeah, so I just wanted to add, although we don't teach, I haven't run into that specific example, what advice I would offer is to teach your children or your students, whatever your role is, that their body is their own, and they can use the language that they have to stand up and say, hey, this is a touch that I don't want. Maybe it's in a place where it feels uncomfortable, or maybe it's by someone that I don't feel comfortable touching me, whether it's a teacher, an older sibling, an older cousin. Maybe I don't feel comfortable with them touching me. It's okay to say no, and it's okay to, you know, take hold of your agency. It's your body, and you get to choose what you do with it.
And Debbie,
yeah, that's great. I also wanted to say that one of the central purposes of parenting is, and schooling, is to help kids learn how to become independent and self-reliant. And bathing can be part of that. So the children can be encouraged at very young ages to wash themselves, to parts of themselves, all of themselves, without bringing undue attention to their the parts. I don't like the phrase private parts because there's a little mixed message in there. They're just parts. Mm. There are parts of us that we keep private most often, but they're not quote-unquote private parts. And it's just a matter of being another part of your body. And the other thing is that as children get older, it often becomes clear that you can just pick it up, that they want more privacy, or you may decide as the parent that you want more privacy, and that's a good time to set a boundary.
Okay. Thank you for following that up. I want to get in an email. Jill emails us, and she says, I've worked with immigrant students from Africa and the Middle East. Have you ever encountered, this is a question for our educators here, have you ever encountered a situation where students are expected to undergo female circumcision? Is that issue and expectations for early marriage and other cultural practices included in training for people who teach sex ed? And I think this is also a separate question that Jill has. Also, what happens if students come into a school system after the grade where sex ed is taught who may not have had sex ed previously? Do we track whether students have had sex ed, and are there catch-up classes for those who don't? Two very good questions.
Okay. So to answer the first question, for training, in training folks who teach sex ed, we do deal with and we do instruct to be sex educators that they take into account cultural differences. I personally have not run into a case, especially where someone has disclosed dealing with female circumcision. Mm-hmm. But we do train sex educators in how to be sensitive to various cultural issues and respond to them accordingly.
Okay. Debbie, do you have thoughts about the catch-up? If there are catch-up classes. I know Park School is going to be different than other schools.
Well, and I don't think Park should be different. I think that, you know, there are learning benchmarks around this subject that have been available to schools for decades, really, mm-hmm. about what should children know when, in order to get this spiraling kind of education going. So all children should be the recipients of that kind of education. It shouldn't depend on the particular school. And so this is one of the things that I feel most passionately about. We have to stop giving ourselves a free pass on this subject. We have to stop giving ourselves reasons why we shouldn't be tackling it, particularly at the lower school level, elementary school level. And I find more and more I call upon myself to encourage schools to take responsibility for what we've really been abdicating. And sexuality in terms of sex and gender are central to human life. And of course, children need the same kind of education about these issues. And you know what? If we do that, lots and lots of problems, including teenage pregnancy and consent issues, will dissipate because, the real purpose is teaching kids not just stuff, but teaching them how to think about issues connected to sex and gender. And if all they have is peers and media, they're never going to get there. Mm. They're not going to be able to think in a sophisticated way.
I wanted to ask a question, Dominique, about media. Last week I saw a movie that's out, a new movie called Eighth Grade. It's really good. I should recommend it for folks. It kind of doesn't deal solely on these topics that we're talking about today, but it does touch on it. In one scene, the main character is talking to a boy that she likes, and he asks her if she does a particular sex act. And she has never had any experience before, but she lies to him and says that she does. And in order to get the information, she goes on YouTube to watch a video. And within 5 seconds, she slams the computer down. She's not comfortable with this. But is this, there's parents who, a lot of school systems teach that they want the parents to be the primary, giver of information. There's schools, there's other programs. But in from your perspective as a young person and in your work as a peer educator, do you hear students talk about sort of supplementing their knowledge by media or in other ways?
Well, I go to BSA. It's very diverse in sexuality, and I'm a sophomore, so most of my friends, we don't really we're starting to like get into sexual things, but me, because I helped Lindsay, one of the peer educator coordinators. Mm-hmm. I helped her with a class and with like juniors and seniors, and from what I heard, it's just miseducation. Like I remember we was talking about STIs, mm-hmm. and we was like, can you get it in your anus? And they was like, no, like you can't get it. And we was like, well, actually you can. And it's just like miseducation. I don't really have experience with certain stuff like sex positions or like anything like that. I just know miseducation, like condoms have pores or like stuff like that, like just miseducation.
Mm. And Debbie or Valerie, do you find students being willing to ask some questions about misconceptions in the classroom?
Yes. Sometimes we flat out ask students, hey, what are some things that you've heard about this topic before we even get into a lesson, mm-hmm. to address some of the misconceptions, mm-hmm. and a way that we make students feel more comfortable with asking questions that they may or may not be sure about, if things are real, if they're not, is we do an anonymous Q&A. We take sticky notes, they put them in a box, we answer them. Nobody knows who the question is from, but everyone gets the information.
Hmm.
Yeah, what I like to do is actually have a special class called Stupid Questions About Sex Day.
Hmm.
And because the older kids are, especially, the more they're sort of defensive about other people thinking they don't know enough, whatever that is, whatever that might be. And they all, when they say, I have a stupid question, what they mean is, I think I'm stupid. I think other kids know the answer to this, and I don't. So I'm not going to raise my hand to ask it. But if you give kids permission, no, everybody feels that way, or most people do, about certain questions. So write them anonymously, whatever it is, and remember that you're the one who's brave enough to write it, but there may be three or four other kids in the room who will be so glad that you wrote it.
And in the few minutes that we have left, I just wanted to ask about sort of any advice you have for parents who, and I'm sure for some parents, I'm not one, it can be uncomfortable for them too to answer certain questions or to broach conversations. Are there resources that you think, Debbie, you might point to your book? I'm kind of giving you a free plug here.
That's what they're for.
Yeah. Resources that you found to be, that parents have found to be helpful, or things that you advise them on?
Yeah, I think there are lots of things out there, which can be easily discovered in a bookstore or on a website like Planned Parenthood or Advocates for Youth, for example. My position about this is really that we need to think about this in terms of all of these subjects, including this one, in terms of normal child and adolescent development and what we can expect. And people have sort of lost. You know, we used to have groups of parents who met very often to find out, and this is something we do at Park School, to find out, who is your child this year? And what are they capable of knowing? And what are they interested in? And then we just weave this subject, instead of making it different, into, you know, the normal dimensions of child and adolescent development. So I encourage parents to read up on that. Who children are, because advertisers increasingly want us to think of children, even young children, as short adult consumers.
I see. How about you, Bella?
From my perspective, I encourage parents to soak up all the information that they can, especially if there was a bridge in their own if there was a gap in their own sex ed. I know people my age who are having kids, they might not have had sex ed at all, or if it was a unit really fast. So some resources that I can share are, of course, our website, ppm.care/education, as well as the Planned Parenthood website, also bedsider.org for birth control methods and STD prevention, and also loveisrespect.org.
We'll try to get some of those links on our website. Go ahead, Debbie.
I think I should mention my website as well, which has lots of resources, and that is talk, and then it's the number two, not T-O, talk2mefirst.com.
All right. Dominique, what do you want educators to keep in mind in this upcoming school year as they prepare to start teaching these lessons to students?
So this summer when I was doing our intense training, we came across a lesson on pronouns and gender fluidity, and it came across my mind that during health classes in middle school, they wasn't really sexually fluent, like they, them. I never heard of they, them. And this summer we had some new peer educators that came in that wanted to be called they, them. And I had some struggles with it. So I just think be more diverse in the education and be more open to it and be like, have a smile on your face. Like, I know I was really scared. I was like, oh my God, these teachers coming in and they're going to think I'm stupid and all that. Aww. Like she said before. Yeah. So just be, just have a smile on your face, be comfortable, open-minded and diverse in pronouns and everything.
Well, thank you so much. That's really good advice, Dominique, and thank you both for joining us and yes, answering these questions. And I had so many more, but as always, we run out of time. So I invite listeners to continue the conversation on Facebook Live if you'd like, and maybe get some more of your questions answered. But yeah, we'll have to leave it there. But thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Debbie Rothman has taught sexuality education at the Park School here in Baltimore for more than 35 years. She is also a consultant and author. Her latest is Talk to Me First, Everything You Need to Know to Become Your Kid's Go-To Person About Sex. Valerie Pasquale is a community health educator with Planned Parenthood of Maryland. Dominique Thurman is a peer educator for Planned Parenthood of Maryland and a sophomore at the Baltimore School for the Arts. Good luck this school year.
Thank you.
Thanks to you all for being here today, including our listeners. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow on the program, guest host Aaron Hankin considers the state of artificial intelligence technology, the next likely advances in AI, and how the human-machine link could be altering the course of our civilization. Thanks to Joe Square for providing lunch to our guests today. Joe Square serves coal-fired pizzas, risottos, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquare.com. I'm Jamila Krempel, and for Tom Hall, thanks for listening. Have a great day.